Do you vape? Or do you know someone who does? If so, we have information today that you should know about. And it's Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and again, we're going to have some valuable information for you. Welcome. Thanks for being a part of the full story. I'm Ron Ropiak. I hope you had a wonderful weekend. A bit later on in the program, we're going to be talking about breast cancer awareness, and we'll get some of the latest information. But we want to start the show today with an update on vaping. I'm sure you heard all the news the past few weeks, so I'm not going to rehash all of that. But you may have missed the news that the other day, a Connecticut resident died from a lung disease related to vaping. The news and the information related to this is changing rapidly. So what we're going to do is call on Connecticut State Senator Mary Daugherty Abrams. She's going to give us the latest. The senator is a Democrat who represents Cheshire, Meriden, Middletown, Middlefield, and Rockfall. And the senator is the co-chair of the Connecticut Public Health Committee. Senator Abrams, welcome. Thanks for being on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Senator, what does the law currently say? How old do you have to be to buy a vaping product in Connecticut?
Well, right now, the new law that we passed, which is referred to as Tobacco 21, does increase the age to buy tobacco products, which include vaping and e-cigarettes, to 21 years old. It doesn't cover, though, any product that does not contain nicotine. So some of the flavors, if there's some kind of gray area there that we need to go back and address.
So there are vaping products without nicotine?
Yes, there are some flavors that they claim have no nicotine in them, but they're not as readily available as the ones with nicotine.
How do you think this new age is going to work? Because I see teens vaping all the time. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you?
Well, in my previous career, I was a high school administrator.
Ah, okay.
So I saw the beginnings of this, and, you know, it's just grown exponentially among our young people. And last session, when we began the session, there was, as part of Tobacco 21, a ban on flavors. And also through the Children's Committee, which I also was chairing at the time, we put through legislation trying to address this problem because we knew that it was running rampant among our young people. I mean, at that point in December of 2018, so almost a year ago, was when the Surgeon General declared it an epidemic amongst our young people. And the CDC roughly estimated that 3 million students were using vaping products when they took account in late 2018. So, you know, we already knew that this was a real problem for our young people. So we tried to put some legislation through. Unfortunately, we weren't successful. Now with the health crisis that's, you know, happened, you referred to the one death, unfortunately, that happened in Connecticut this month. And there have been, to my knowledge, 18 deaths in the United States at this point and over 1,000 lung injuries in 48 states. So we know that this is really a problem. And so I'm hoping that we're more successful this session in getting some legislation passed to address it. I feel that the schools have really been doing their part in terms of education of our young people, in terms of, you know, trying to help them understand, to give in appropriate consequences, and all the things that they can do. And now it's time for the legislators to step up and support that effort.
Senator, you talk about everything that the schools are doing. Do you think parents realize how bad this is?
I think they're starting to. I don't think that they originally did. Again, in my former role, I mean, we had parents who were the ones that were purchasing the vaping products. The reason being, I know, you know, parents care about their kids, and I don't think that they realize the dangers involved. And if you remember, vaping and e-cigarettes first came about because they were touted as being a way to stop smoking cigarettes. And so I think that originally people thought of them as not being harmful, and that was obviously not true. I've always had a feeling that it didn't seem right to me that you could be turning some chemicals into an aerosol and putting it in your lungs, and that wasn't going to have any repercussions. I just didn't know when we'd see those repercussions happened, you know, maybe later for these young people, similar to what the kind of arc of tobacco use was, that, you know, for my grandparents' generation, they didn't really know that this was going to turn out the way we've seen it turn out. So I was concerned about it a long time ago. However, I think some parents, just because of the way that it had been marketed, felt that it wasn't harmful. And I think the more that we're getting the word out there to parents, to students, making it more of a cultural shift that rather than having peer pressure to use vaping products, the peer pressure, similar to the way we had been moving with cigarettes, becomes you shouldn't really be using that. So I think that we're educating parents along the way as well. I know schools have been doing forums. I know that there's legislators that have done forums just to get the word out there to talk about why vaping is bad for you. And I'm going to be doing a forum this Thursday in Cheshire at the Cheshire Town Council to bring the community together to answer questions and to, you know, talk about the dangers of vaping.
So what can the state of Connecticut actually do? Can it ban the sale of vaping products or part of them? And how can it legally do that?
It can if it goes through the proper channels. I'm sure you know that the governor of New York recently banned them, but that is now in the appellate court because they're questioning whether or not the governor has the ability to really do that. So there are questions about whether, you know, how you can go about a ban, but certainly the legislature has the ability to pass laws that would say that you cannot sell those products here in Connecticut, or at the very least, be very diligent about where those products are sold. One of the things I've been looking at is, you know, right now some of these products are available the same places you could buy cigarettes, which would be, you know, in the gas station or the 7-Eleven or the Quickie Mart kind of, you know, marketplace, as opposed to a vaping store. I think that gives, when you can sell it in so many places, it just gives more opportunities for young people to get their hands on them. So there's different ways. There's a full-out ban, and then there's also ways that we could kind of control the sale where the product's available.
I guess what I'm trying to understand is how the state can try to ban or restrict e-cigarettes, but they're not able to do the same for so-called traditional cigarettes.
Well, I think they could do the same thing for traditional cigarettes. I don't think that there's been an appetite to do that.
Oh, okay. Connecticut, as you mentioned, is, well, you didn't mention the special session, but I do know that Connecticut is considering a special session in the next month or so to tackle a number of different issues. If the special session moves forward, will vaping be one of the issues, or is this going to have to wait till the next regular session next year?
I think that it will probably wait until the next session next year because, you know, when you're doing legislation that's that encompassing, I think it's really important to follow the process, to allow it to go through the committees, to allow there to be public hearing, so that you really give all sides the opportunity to be heard before those decisions are made. That being said, they certainly could bring it up as part of the special session, and there is some, you know, that has been talked about. As to whether or not that's going to happen, I don't know.
Some who have said that the real problem is that there are those who are vaping and they're using black market vaping products. So my question for you is, if you ban it, won't that just make the black market products even more attractive?
I think that's always a danger, you know, that will happen. But my focus really is how we keep it out of the hands of our children, especially, and I think that they're less inclined to go towards black market, especially if they never start to begin with. And one of the reasons that we passed Tobacco 21 was that we found that a lot of young people got their hands on nicotine products from their older age peers, from the 18 to 21-year-olds. And so that was a good reason, one of the many good reasons, to raise the age to 21, because the longer it takes someone to start, the less likely they are to start and to continue using a product like that. So I don't discount the fact that there is a black market. There's a black market now. But I think that children are less likely to access that.
Senator, I have 1 minute left in the segment. Should Connecticut try to tackle this on a regional basis, work with Massachusetts and New York?
Absolutely. I think that anything we do in this kind of way is always good to work with our neighbors, Rhode Island, Massachusetts, New York, and to come up with plans together, or at least as much as we can. I think we all acknowledge that this is a problem and that we want to protect our young people. So if we can reach out to them and find ways to work together, all the better.
Have you been approached by any health officials from those other states?
No, I have not. I know that our governor was in contact with the governor of New York, and I believe also he was speaking with the governor of Massachusetts and Rhode Island, and I think that the commissioners of the public health department are the ones that reach out to our neighbors in that way.
Is there anything else we should know about what is taking place with vaping in Connecticut nowadays? We have about 20 seconds left.
The last thing I would just like to say is to thank you for doing this, because, again, I think the more we get the word out, we assume that people know and they realize what's going on with this. Like I said before, I think parents want the best for their children. And I think to get that message out, to really let them know how dangerous this is, just might save a kid. And that's what we want to do. So I thank you very much for doing this segment and to keep the light focused on this problem so that we can save more kids.
Connecticut State Senator Mary Daugherty Abrams, the co-chair of the Connecticut Public Health Committee. Senator, thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thanks for your time.
If you'd like to comment on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org, and you can find us on Facebook at Full Story WSHU. We'll take our first break. We'll be right back. In our first segment today, we spoke with the senator about the latest news concerning vaping, the health consequences, what's being done or proposed in our region to deal with what some are calling a health emergency. And now we're going to continue the discussion with two guests that we're bringing in. Dr. Irfan Rahman is with the University of Rochester Medical Center School of Medicine and Dentistry. He focuses on e-cigarettes and vaping. Dr. Rahman, welcome, sir.
Thank you so much.
And Brett Dahlberg is also joining us. Brett is a health reporter and producer for WXXI News. Brett, how are you today?
Doing well. Thanks for having me.
Brett, I'm going to start with you, if that's all right. Can you bring us up to date on what New York State is attempting to do with the proposed ban on flavored e-cigarettes? And what have the courts said about that?
Sure. So New York had been set to put a ban on possession and sale of e-cigarettes into a flavored e-cigarettes into effect on Friday last week. And then on Thursday afternoon, an appellate court in Albany put a temporary hold on it. And the last that I've heard is that the next court date around that ban is October 18th. So there's a temporary hold. The industry groups that were suing to block enforcement of the ban hailed the decision, and the state said this is not going to stop us. This is just a temporary delay.
Can you clarify something for me? Because I was a little confused when I was talking with the senator in our first segment. Do flavored e-cigarettes contain nicotine?
Often, yes. It's possible to not have that. But the vast majority of and the concern around youth use in particular is that e-cigarettes can often contain a lot of nicotine, especially flavored ones.
So going back to what we were talking about just a moment ago, Governor Cuomo is attempting to do this by executive order. Is that right? And the vaping industry says, look, you don't have the right to do this. Is that basically it?
It's not technically an executive order. It's carried out by the state health department. And so it's a health regulation. But yes, it's an emergency regulation that lasts for 90 days before it needs to be renewed.
Dr. Rahman, welcome, sir. The state health commissioner in New York, Howard Zucker, says this is a public health emergency. And using his words, he says, this demands immediate action to help ensure the well-being of our children. Is he right? Is this a public health emergency?
Yes. Well, thanks for having me here. To some extent, it's correct because the survey in 2017 publication in JAMA clearly said that the flavor tobacco products, in particular electronic cigarettes, have been used by teenagers in high schoolers and middle schoolers. So there is a perception that if you can regulate or ban these products, so children won't get access to these, and hence this will not be a gateway for smoking. That's the assumption, that's the perception being taken by our commissioner. And the one of the main things which Brett highlighted, or he alluded, that this ban temporarily put on hold, this is not due to the fact that this will be unblocked. This is mainly due to the vendors. They have these products in their shop, in their inventory, so they would like to clear up these products. That's why that's perhaps the temporary block on the bans are.
Brett, I understand what the doctor is saying, because I have read some reports where shop owners say, look, I have spent tens of thousands of dollars. What am I going to do with all of this now?
Sure. I talked to on the Thursday afternoon when the state was barred from enforcing the ban. I talked to a shop owner in Greece, which is a suburb of Rochester out here in upstate New York. And she said about 40% of her floor space was taken up by products that she had started to pack up, and she had started to try to get rid of those products. And now, you know, suddenly she is allowed to continue selling them. And she said, well, she's glad that she's allowed to continue selling those products. The unpredictability was taking a toll. She just wasn't sure sort of what each day was going to bring.
I wonder if there are some who are rushing into the stores now to stockpile, if you will.
I've definitely talked to people who are users of flavored e-cigarettes who have said they have been stocking up. And researchers in particular, like Dr. Rahman, have also been trying to get these products to do the research on them before the state doesn't allow them to be sold anymore.
Brett, you bring up a good point, and that was going to lead me into my discussion with Dr. Rahman. Doctor, you've been doing research on the effects of vaping. How long have you been doing the research?
Yeah, we started doing research since the inception or the beginning of electronic cigarette came into the U.S., which is 2005, 2006. First, I got electronic cigarette from Germany, actually. So that was not in our country. So I started doing, but we had first publication in early 2010s where we showed that, you know, these flavors are not safe. They are harmful to the lungs. And we've been informing the regulators that, you know, these flavors with and without nicotine, and even PGVG, which is polyethylene glycol, glycerin, are added as a humectant to keep this as a liquid. They're also harmful. So we are doing since last almost 10, 12 years this kind of research. And we have been purchasing and we have been stocking up all the electronic juices, flavor, unflavored tobacco flavors, and menthol flavors in our lab. So assuming that if the ban is there, then at least we can have these flavors and we can still do research and we can inform the federal government, look, these are harmful or they are less harmful.
So you have enough for research for the future, but if I could understand this correctly, you were telling the regulators and the health officials for close to a decade that you thought that there were health concerns here?
Yes, we have been informing through our research, and we wrote a review, in fact, in Toxicology Journal, that these flavors contain various chemicals. And those chemicals, I can give you an example. Like, for example, when you have a popcorn in movie theater, cinemas, those popcorns, sometimes they are added with a butter, and those butter can be a chemical butter. Those contains diacetyl, 2,3-pentanedione. These are some of the examples. These are not necessarily be a real butter. These are chemicals, and they flavor, they smell, and they look like original butter. So those chemicals are toxic when they are added into the lungs when a person inhales, and not necessarily when we eat and digestion. Our gut is meant for those things, so we are okay. Lungs are not prepared for those inhalation inhale products. So we've been informing the regulators by using our research, that these are not safe.
Brett, you've been reporting on this for quite a number of years. Why did it take so long for this information to get out to the public? Or was it there and it was just ignored?
So the issue that regulators have been wrestling with for a while now is, on balance, whether e-cigarettes can offer... It's not accurate to say that e-cigarettes are healthy, according to, you know, the vast majority of people that I've talked to, but they can offer a healthier alternative than conventional combustible cigarettes. And so regulators have been having to wrestle with whether, on balance, allowing people to use devices that they know can have some negative health consequences is worth it if it takes people away from using conventional cigarettes that they know are likely worse. When that becomes difficult, though, to sustain that balance is when people who have not used conventional cigarettes take up smoking e-cigarettes. And that's what we've seen in recent years with youth use of flavored e-cigarettes. It's gone up 160% in New York State over the last few years, and 45% of high school seniors in Monroe County, where I'm doing my reporting, have reported using flavored e-cigarettes at some point in their high school career. And so at that point, it became harder for regulators to sustain the idea that they're trying to create a balance on the harm reduction strategy. The difficulty that they encountered was that youth who had never used cigarettes were now going right into using e-cigarettes, not as a smoking cessation device, but as a smoking device in the first place.
Dr. Rahman, I have satellite radio in my car, and when I do some driving over the weekend, I flip around, I listen to a number of different stations, and for a while it seemed like every other commercial I heard was about a vaping product. Have you heard them, and what did you think when you were listening to the ads?
Yes, I've heard actually, and now it is middle of the night, you can see views and blue, they come and they advertise these things. So these are the way to attract people for, as Brett highlighted, that it's just like a cessation device. But the FDA has their own cessation device where you can go and buy those patches, nicotine gums, things like that. Those are, some people say that they are not working. So the media bringing these, companies bringing these ads, saying that these are safer, you can switch from, you got your freedom back from using these flavors or vapors or aerosol, and some people say even is a water vapor. So these are the perception among our community and the users. So FDA issued a deeming rule in 2014 about the regulation of these flavored products, and FDA has been slightly slow, been thinking about nicotine reduction in the in electronic cigarettes and other tobacco products. But they were aware of the flavors, but they just perhaps were a little bit slower because the recent episodes of hospitalization and deaths actually triggered the whole regulators and then the agencies to come forward with some sort of a strict regulation and guidelines, and hence this put ban on these flavors. These are two separate things. Vaping, these THC drive product versus flavors. So the companies who are advertising, they are mainly the people who are selling nicotine, with nicotine, without nicotine, and flavors. So I feel like those things should be regulated as well, and they should be put in a perspective that a person, when he uses, which would know the risk of having lung diseases or harmful effects of these compounds or flavors into their system.
Brett, what's your reporting telling you? Are the states in our region going to go it alone, if you will, or are they going to band together to tackle this on a regional basis?
It's hard to make any of those predictions, but I mean, we do know that the governors of, you know, of New York, of Connecticut, of Massachusetts have been meeting. I've heard from Governor Cuomo's communication staff that he is looking to create what they called regional synergy in their approach to e-cigarettes. And so it's hard to know, you know, precisely what the outcome would be of any of that, but it definitely does seem like they're trying to get at least some regional buy-in to make the rules consistent, whatever they come up with.
Dr. Rahman, what would you like the states to do now?
Well, states, this is important. We concur with the regulation and the ban of flavor. Tobacco flavors and the menthol on Section 212, Title 10, they are exempted. But now recently they came forward with, okay, menthol should also be regulated. And I kind of concur with the regulation that tobacco itself has dozens of tobacco flavors, and those are chemicals, actually. So I am in favor of the ban, and some of those products should be regulated as well, like menthol. If we go ahead with menthol, should be regulated, and at least should be given a kind of information to users what they are using, what can cause the damage. So I'm in favor of the ban, and actually it has to be the nationwide ban, and maybe our New York state is the first leading front, and hopefully the other states will follow. And that's what my 2 cents here.
And Brett, with the 2 minutes that we have left, I was wondering if you could clear something up for me, because I've read a lot about this over the last number of weeks. And I guess I'm a little confused when I hear the term black market vaping. Where are these black market products coming from, and why are they so dangerous?
So part of that is hard to answer simply because of the nature of a black market, which is that it's underground, right, and not welcoming a lot of scrutiny. But what we can tell so far is that it's not difficult to, it's not easy for everybody, but given the right set of tools and supplies, it's not all that difficult to manufacture products that, liquids that you could put in an e-cigarette and vape. Dr. Rahman showed me some of how they can do that in the lab. And so all you need at that point is packaging. Mm. And for people who are trying to use, jam more nicotine or to use THC, to use products that are illicit in their vapes, it's turned out to not be all that difficult to find those things and to be able to use them. So the reason that seems to have come up so much more in the national consciousness recently is that there's been some very slick packaging products that have allowed people to sell illicit e-cigarette products to a pretty large market, and it turns out that those have not been safe for some users, and people have been dying.
So you're saying that there are some who actually maybe have like a small manufacturing facility who are putting this together, but it also sounds from what you're saying that if someone really wanted to do it, they could almost do it in the back room of the house.
The house in the Midwest where the largest, as far as I know, black market operation has been found was, just a suburban house where people were putting together a lot of illicit e-cigarette products.
Learned a lot today. Thank you, guys. I mean, it was very educational. Brett Dahlberg is a health reporter and a producer for WXXI News. Brett, it was a pleasure meeting you, and thank you for your time today.
Happy to do it. Thanks for having me.
And Dr. Irfan Rahman is with the University of Rochester, the Medical Center School of Medicine and Dentistry. And Dr. Rahman concentrates on e-cigarettes and vaping, and he's been doing research for quite some time now. Dr. Rahman, thank you, sir. We appreciate your expertise.
Thank you so much for having me here.
And now in this final segment, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about it being Breast Cancer Awareness Month. And to give us some information, we're calling on Ryan Tollefson. Ryan is the community health manager with the Susan G. Komen Organization of New England. Ryan, welcome. Thanks for your time today. How are you?
Great. Thanks so much for having me, Ron.
It's our pleasure. Also joining us is Maria Romero, who's the ambassador for Latina Share on Long Island. Hi, Maria. How are you?
Hi. Very good. Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you on the program. Ryan, I'm going to start with you, if that's all right.
Yes.
Breast Cancer Awareness Month started, what, back in 85?
It's been around for a while, yes. And it has certainly grown throughout the years. And it's really, you know, we talk about it being Breast Cancer Awareness Month, but we like to think of it as an opportunity for education and a means to an end to ensuring that people are both aware of breast cancer in general, but also have the education they need to make the right choices for their personal history.
I was just thinking about how long it's been around, and I was thinking, man, yeah, who could have imagined that it would have grown into this worldwide movement that we see today?
Absolutely, absolutely. But it is, you know, goes to show that breast cancer is a disease that touches just about everybody. You know, in the United States, 1 in every 8 women will be diagnosed in her lifetime. So everybody knows somebody. And October and it being Breast Cancer Awareness Month gives everyone an opportunity to kind of reflect on that, learn a little bit more, support those that have been touched by it. And it certainly, like you said, has grown a lot over the years.
Ryan, tell us a little bit about the Susan G. Komen organization.
Sure. So Susan G. Komen is a national organization that was started when Susie Komen died of metastatic breast cancer back in 1980, and her sister promised that she would do anything in her power to end breast cancer forever. So it started with a promise between two sisters and has really grown over the years. I represent Komen New England, which is the local affiliate of Susan G. Komen. So we provide community health programs throughout New England to make sure that people are receiving the care they need. Our mission is to address those disparities and inequities in the healthcare system to ensure access to all.
Maria, I'm going to get to you in 1 second. I just want to squeeze in one more question for Ryan. Ryan, could you tell us about the breast cancer rates in Connecticut and New York? What are the numbers? How do they compare to past years?
Sure, sure. So in Connecticut, it's estimated that there will be about 3,500 breast cancer diagnoses in 2019 and 430 deaths. Unfortunately, Connecticut has, it's not an honor, the opposite of an honor, of being one of the highest, one of the states with the highest incidence rates in the country. We're just behind New Hampshire and D.C. for incidence rates. There's a couple of reasons that that may be, but we do need to keep an eye on breast cancer trends and rates in Connecticut and ensure that screening services and treatment services are available to everybody.
So can you give me some of those reasons why it might be so high in Connecticut?
Sure. So there could be lots of different reasons, and you know, some of it are just conjectures that we can make. But we do know that socioeconomics and education factor significantly into breast cancer rates. We also know that throughout New England and Connecticut, we do have higher screening rates. So having higher screening rates, there is a correlation between that and higher incidence rates, of course, because more people are going to those mammography screening appointments. You know, there are lots of different things that we could talk about. Genetics plays an important part in breast cancer. So it could be a genetic connection just in our demographics in this area. But, you know, overall, the important message, too, is to remember that in Connecticut and throughout the country, African-American women are more likely to die from breast cancer. So that's an important thing just to keep in mind when you're thinking about the overall trends in breast cancer in the state.
Maria, are you still there?
Yes, I am here.
Okay, thank you. You have great patience. I appreciate it. Thank you for staying with us. Maria Romero is with us. She is an ambassador for Latina Share on Long Island. And Maria, you work with women in the Brentwood area, right?
Yes, in the Brentwood. Yes.
Okay, tell us a little bit about Latina Share.
Okay, Latina Share. This November, we have a big party because we are celebrating our 25 years in Latina Share. And I am ambassador of the program, and I am group facilitator in Brentwood. We have around 40 ladies in the support group.
And what do you do?
I am going to the consulate to give the information to the ladies. We have a comic book, information about the ovarian cancer, breast cancer, and I am talking with the ladies about the mammogram, the prevention, and especially with my community.
So you bring the information to them?
Yes, and the consulate on the health fairs, or I am going to talk with them, and I inform them about the helpline, because we have a helpline in 24 hours, 7 days a week, in 9 languages. And they can call them and give information about the breast and ovarian cancer.
The women that you are working with, that you're getting the information to, do most of them have health insurance?
No. The most ladies stay in the support group doesn't have insurance. And they need a lot of help. They need the help in many ways. But we have resource to help them. In Suffolk County, there are a cancer service, a program to can help the ladies with no insurance or doesn't have papers yet.
Okay. Ryan, I'm going to change topic just a tiny bit, but not much. Obviously, women are most affected by this horrible illness. But what do men also need to know? Because I have read that 1% of men get breast cancer.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that's the most important thing to know, is that it is possible for men to get breast cancer. You know, our Komen's key message for everybody is to know your normal. So know what's normal for you. And if something doesn't look right, doesn't feel right, you need to have that conversation with your doctor. And because I think the education is just not out there as much that men can get breast cancer too, it often goes undetected for much longer than it should be, because the awareness just isn't there that it's a possibility for men as well. So know your normal.
Speaking from a guy's point of view, I have to say that I have never known any men to speak about this.
Yeah. Yeah. There are very active men's support groups. Komen actually has a telephone men's support group on their Komen's Breast Care Helpline. So they are out there, but it's just a story that doesn't often get told.
Is it also that men, I mean, they don't like to share this, or they for some reason there's a stigma attached to it?
I think that is certainly part of it. You know, it's something that people don't really talk about. You know, having the conversation about breast cancer has been an evolving conversation over the past, you know, generation or so. And we're catching up there in terms of male breast cancer, but the awareness, the education, and the ability to talk about it is not there. Like you said, 1% of breast cancer diagnoses are in men. So it is rare, but it does happen, and it is something to keep an eye out for any man.
You know, you're absolutely right. When I think back to it, you know, years ago, 30 years ago, 40 years ago, you would never talk about breast cancer, especially on the radio, public airwaves. Mm-hmm. You would never say that.
Right. It's certainly been an evolving conversation. You know, when Komen was started as an organization in the early 1980s, you couldn't say breast cancer in the media, and people just didn't talk about it. So we've come a long way in being able to talk about it and get the information out there and spread the education and awareness and what needs to be known in the general public. But we have some ways to go, especially when it comes to talking about male breast cancer.
Maria, you were saying before that some of the women in your group are undocumented. What happens when they are diagnosed with cancer? What do they do? What special needs do they have?
Yeah, first they need to apply to cancer service, and then cancer service give them the help to them. But when they are going to the support group, they receive the hopeless. You know, I have a very young lady in my support group. Her name is Yancy. She has only 18 years old. It's too hard. And the other ladies, when finished the treatment, The problem is that all day when we have the insurance, you can get the your everything, your reconstruction, everything. But these ladies, only the doctor put the tissue at the standard. And sometimes they need to wait 5 years, or maybe that expandex explodes in their bodies. And it's too hard because that procedure is expensive. There are very good doctors. They can help them, and they can make the surgery for free or only for like a sliding scale.
Maria, I appreciate all this information, but I guess what I'm getting at is that there is such fear right now in the undocumented immigrant community just because of everything that is taking place nowadays, that I'm sure if someone comes down with such a catastrophic illness, the fear and the concerns and the anxiety must be overwhelming.
Yeah, it's hard. It's hard to me to talk about that because my community needs a lot of help, and they have help with this program. But then when there are many, a share can assist this with a support group, but we connect with another organization and help to them too.
Ryan, could you give us some practical advice? How often should we be screened? What are the symptoms that we should be looking for?
Yeah, so there are a number of different symptoms that are warning signs for breast cancer. But it really what it boils down to is what I said before. You need to know you're normal. If you see any lumps, swelling, hardness, redness, changes in size or shape, anything like that, we are our own best advocates. We know our bodies better than anybody else does. So it's important that we empower ourselves to speak up and say if something seems strange, different, unusual, whatever that might be. There are a number of different recommendations for screening guidelines based on different organizations. So it's a conversation that we would encourage with a doctor based on a personal health history, family background, ancestry. Those are all things that will impact whether or not you should start having mammograms at 40 or if it should be, you know, 50 or so. Or for women who are at higher risk, you might need to start mammography services or screening services earlier than that as well. And it's important to note that young women can and do get breast cancer as well. So it's really a conversation with your physician so you can make the best choice for you.
Can breast cancer strike at any age?
Absolutely. Like Maria just said, she has a patient who or a person in her group who is 18. And sadly, it can affect young women. And similar to the story with men, a lot of people just don't think about young women getting breast cancer. But it is certainly possible. It can impact at any age. The median age is closer to 60 to 65 for most groups of people, but it can certainly happen earlier than that. So just being aware and knowing what's normal for you is really the most important message.
And what should men do? How should they check?
Again, that's a conversation with your doctor. Men can also receive mammograms if they think that there's something unusual going on. But it's an ongoing conversation to have with your primary care physician or nurse or whoever it might be that you see on a regular basis that can kind of help you decide what's going to work best for you.
Maria, I have about 2 minutes left. If someone wants to get more information on Latina Share, how can they do so?
Yes, they can call us to the support line on 1-866-537-4273. I am breast cancer survivor. I am 9 years cancer survivor. And that is why the most women's working share are survivors. And they understand the other lady and the other side.
I want to make sure that I got that number right. You said 866-537.
1-866-537. 866-537-4273.
866-537-4273, if you would like to get in
contact. 4273,
yes. Get in contact with Latina Share. Ryan, with the minute and a half that we have left, what information should we know about that I haven't asked you that you would like to get out there, please?
I would also just encourage people, if you do not have insurance or you are underinsured, the Connecticut Department of Health has a great breast and cervical cancer early detection program. You can give them a call or look on their website for providers in your area. The most important thing is that you see that doctor and you have that conversation so that we can all be vigilant about our health.
And do you have any special observances coming up in the next few weeks in our region?
We are going to be at a number of different businesses doing lunch and learns, education events in different areas. We actually just had an event earlier in the Hartford area. So we're kind of all over the place, and you can always check out our website at comannewengland.org for our calendar of events.
And there's always something going on in Connecticut and New York this time of the year. So it's great
Absolutely.
To see. Ryan, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Ryan Tollefson, who is the community health manager with the Susan G. Komen Organization of New England. And Maria Romero is the ambassador for Latina Share. 866-537-4273. Right, Maria?
Yes, that's right.
Thank you, Maria. Be well. And congratulations on your 9 years.
Okay, thank you so much.
Thank you. And thanks again, Ryan. If you would like to comment on today's program, email us. We're at tfs@wshu.org. I hope we provided some good information today. tfs@wshu.org. On Facebook, hopefully you'll like us. We're at Full Story WSHU, and all our shows are available as podcasts. You can download the Full Story on Spotify, on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, or Google Play. That's going to do it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Fatou Sangari, Sabrina Garone, Roberto Rojas. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan is our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to you for being part of The Full Story.